You're listening to The Monocle Daily, first broadcast on the 4th of October 2017 on Monocle 24. The Monocle Daily, in association with UBS.
Hello from Midori House in London and welcome to the Monocle Daily here on Monocle 24 with me, Paul Osborne. Coming up in the program.
In the months ahead, we will all have to wrestle with the horror of what has unfolded this week, but we will struggle through it together. We will endure the pain together and we will overcome together as Americans.
Donald Trump is in Las Vegas, but can the president measure up to his predecessors, offering comfort at a time of tragedy? In Portugal, the country's former prime minister steps back from frontline politics after another electoral drubbing. We'll ask what his party should do next. Halfway between Norway and the North Pole, a row is erupting over a sparsely populated place that could be worth a fortune. We'll learn more later. Also ahead, we'll get the lowdown on this year's Frieze Art Fair in London, catch up on the latest fashion, and find out about Google's new answer to the iPhone. All in the next hour on the Monocle Daily, live from London on Monocle 24. First, though, a quick look at some of the day's other top news stories. The leader of Catalonia has attacked the King of Spain after he criticised the region's controversial independence referendum. Carles Puigdemont said that King Felipe had ignored millions of Catalans in his comments, in which he accused the region's leaders of acting outside the law and warned that Spain was facing dangerous times. The US Secretary of State Rex Tillerson has denied reports of a rift with Donald Trump after claims that he'd called the president a moron during a meeting. He rejected reports that he considered resigning earlier this year, saying his commitment to the Trump administration was as strong as ever. Iraq's military says it stormed the town of Hawija, one of the last enclaves under the control of Islamic State militants. Soldiers, special forces and police reached the centre of the town after breaking through jihadist defences, 2 days after taking control of an airbase to the south. It's the latest significant victory for pro-government forces in their battle against the extremists. And one of Germany's most prominent right-wing politicians has been charged with perjury. Franka Petri, a former leader of the AfD party, is accused of lying under oath about campaign financing. But prosecutors will need to apply to lift her parliamentary immunity if she's to go to trial. Last week, she quit the AfD days after it won more than 12% of the votes in Germany's parliamentary election. Oh, welcome to tonight's Monocle Daily. First, Donald Trump's sporadic outbursts and Twitter spats are often met with a sarcastic raise of the eyebrow and a few jokes. But this week is different. Yesterday, the US president was in Puerto Rico, still reeling from a hurricane that left many of its citizens in dire need of help and exposed the leadership in Washington that seemed unable or unwilling to act. Today, Mr. Trump is in Las Vegas, where 58 people were killed in America's worst ever mass shooting. This is, after all, a key role that the president must fulfill, consoler-in-chief, as it were. But rarely has the office been held by someone seemingly so ill-prepared for such a task. Well, let's find out how he's done now by talking to Scott Lucas, Professor of International Politics at the University of Birmingham. Scott, the president arrived in Las Vegas around 5 hours ago. He's been meeting some of the first responders who helped in the aftermath of the shooting. And after some of his past performances, you can understand why people were nervous about how this would go.
Well, he didn't do anything horribly wrong, you know, and tear the place up. In contrast to Puerto Rico yesterday, which was marked by some rather unusual incidents, such as when he started throwing paper towels into the crowd. He stuck very closely to a script today, both when he met the first responders and then in a scripted statement, which expressed sorrow, which thanked those who arrived at the scene, and which said that America would overcome tragedy. All standard lines you would expect a president to deliver, but he delivered them in a very un-Trumpian wooden style, almost as if he was on a leash to make sure that he didn't go off script.
And that's very similar to the remarks that he made in the hours after the shooting in Las Vegas. Again, a very formal, clearly very tightly scripted response. This shouldn't be a difficult job for a president. Part of the job of that that role of being leader of the country is finding the right words at times of tragedy.
Well, I think there's a background to this that's quite interesting to make comparison. If you talk about a Ronald Reagan, who was not liked by many people in the country, could be a divisive president, but when he spoke after the Challenger disaster in which American astronauts were killed, it was a unifying speech, you know, that they reached up to the stars, for example. After 9/11, George Bush, again, disliked by many people in the U.S., but in that speech at Ground Zero at New York City, when he rallied everybody, it was sort of a clarion call in terms of that America could recover. Donald Trump, for two reasons, hasn't done that. The first is that Trump just isn't a unifier. Trump doesn't take criticism well. You're either with him or against him. So, for example, in the Puerto Rico appearance, the mayor of San Juan was there, who he had attacked on Twitter vehemently, simply because she had asked for a quicker recovery effort. So that trip was tinged with the idea of how are you rallying everybody? And then the second reason is, quite honestly, Trump just doesn't have that type of compassion. There's nothing in his tone, nothing in his mannerism in terms of embracing people. And when he tries to do it, he comes across as false. He's a much more confrontational individual.
And as much as he can be given the scripted right words at a time like this, as we move on from the immediate aftermath of the shooting in Las Vegas, the debate inevitably is going to move on to arguments about gun control, about the need for tighter legislation. Now, the White House has said so far that it's too soon to talk about it. Donald Trump has said that they will talk about it at some stage. But even when that conversation begins, this is a president who took huge campaign donations from the NRA and in return offered huge promises of support.
Let's just deal with this. That conversation's never going to happen. I mean, even under a President Obama, who wanted to do something to control guns, the administration was largely ineffective. I mean, they just tinkered around the edges with gun registration. Trump and his administration have already pushed back what Obama did achieve, which was, for example, getting background checks on people who had issues of mental health. Just this week, Congress is going to vote on measures that actually relax gun laws. For example, allowing people to buy silencers or to move guns across state lines. So we're not going to have a conversation about gun control. The broader issue is whether Las Vegas has already been overtaken by other issues. So it's notable today that even as Trump is trying to show authority, the number one story is not his speech. The number one story is that his Secretary of State, as you had heard in your headlines, called him a moron in July. And all the Washington media is now over this apparent split within the administration rather than talking about the Las Vegas show.
Now, there's two things. I, before we move on to talk about Rex Tillerson, which I want to get your views on that in a moment, but from the perspective of someone on the other side of the Atlantic, in the past, when we've had these kind of shootings in the US, there has at least been some sort of half-serious conversation about tightening gun control laws before it got bogged down in Washington. What seems different about this one is that, as you just said, the response is that, well, of course this isn't going to change anything. There is just an assumption now that it doesn't matter how many times this happens, how many people are killed, the gun laws are not going to be changed.
Well, I think part of it, at least for me, is that I'm just jaded. You know, several years ago, I remember speaking to radio outlets about the mass killing at Sandy Hook, at the school where children and teachers were killed. And I said that nothing would happen after that. And indeed, the most that the Obama administration got was a fact-finding committee that went nowhere. Then when Orlando occurred just over a year ago, where almost 50 people were killed, it very quickly was framed as being, quote, possibly terrorism rather than an issue of gun control, and nothing happened. You know, we're in like a Groundhog's Day cycle, that these mass killings occur not just, you know, once every few weeks. They occur each day, you know, almost one per day of three or more people killed in a single shooting. So now that's the first reason I'm jaded. And the second is as you already pointed out, there's absolutely no will on behalf of Donald Trump and on behalf of those in the administration to do anything about guns. If anything, it's exactly the opposite. Remember, Trump as a candidate was a person who said, actually threatened Hillary Clinton in a campaign speech, because when she hinted she might do something about guns, Donald Trump said darkly to the crowd, well, you know that you can do something about that.
Let's briefly touch on that Rex Tillerson story that, as you say, is already gripping Washington to the exclusion of the Las Vegas shooting. He came out a few hours ago and said he had not considered resigning, that he had not had to be talked out of resigning by Mike Pence, which was the core of this report that NBC released this morning. But did he deny that he called the president a moron?
No. He evaded the question.
It's rather telling.
It's extremely telling. It's like similar, you know, remember the old British House of Cards comment, I could not possibly comment on that. Tillerson said, in effect, well, it's too petty to comment, but it's the same thing. The NBC News story behind this had a dozen sources from within the White House or close to Trump. So that story appears to be standing up. And what is even more significant today than Tillerson's comment, which was from July, is that a leading GOP senator, the head of the Foreign Relations Committee, Bob Corker, has said, thank God for Chief of Staff John Kelly, thank God for Tillerson, thank God for the Defense Secretary James Mattis, because they are what is preventing the U.S. from falling into chaos. In other words, they're saving us from Donald Trump. And very quickly, journalists who were in the know in Washington said that Corker was merely saying what many people on Capitol Hill, and indeed some of them inside the administration, have been saying privately.
The alarm there being that if Rex Tillerson really has been considering walking away, we've seen John Kelly with his head in his hands at more than one Donald Trump public speaking engagement. So are they all going to make it to 2020 and save us for another 3.5 years?
Well, I think they intend to. I mean, one of the open secrets in Washington is that James Mattis, the defense secretary, and the national security advisor, H.R. McMaster, have an agreement that at least one of them is in Washington at any given time, because they don't leave Trump on his own. When there had been talk about whether or not any of these individuals should resign, say after the Charlottesville white supremacist violence that Trump would not denounce, the implicit remark that came from their staffs is, look, they're not resigning because they feel they have to be there, because the alternative is just much worse, leaving Trump effectively on his own. And I think given the gathering Russia investigation, given Trump's unpredictability over the North Korean crisis, I see merit in that position.
Scott, thank you very much for your time this evening. That's Scott Lucas, Professor of International Politics at the University of Birmingham. You're listening to Monocle 24. Now, voters around the world have proved time and again that while their support can be fickle, they can also bear grudges for a long time. Well, the latest politician to learn that is former Portuguese Prime Minister Pedro Passos Coelho, who is to stand down as leader of the country's main opposition party. It's after it suffered a heavy defeat in local elections, apparently continued punishment for the austerity measures that he imposed while in office. Well, we can speak now to Pedro Santos Guerreiro, who's the executive editor of Expresso, which is a weekly Portuguese newspaper. How bad was the defeat for his party in these elections?
Well, it was a disaster. It was the worst outcome, electoral result ever. It was a local election, and they have lost not only a lot of votes, but they were almost humiliated in the biggest cities of Portugal. So it really was a disaster. Mr. Passos Coelho had previously said that he wouldn't resign whatever the result would be, but he then announced that he would step down because the result was much worse than expected, even in the polls that had been published before.
He's had a bad run of luck, imposing austerity measures that saw unemployment hit records, living standards fall, but then also widely were credited with saving the Portuguese economy from collapse. May well have had a hand in the growth that the current Prime Minister is enjoying, but he paid the price for that at the election 2 years ago and seems to still be paying that price.
Well, yeah, he did. He governed the country in the bailout program between 2011 and 2015, and he did put forward a lot of austerity measures. He cut down the civil servants' salaries. He rose all kind of taxes. And Portugal was kind of a poster boy in the European Union, unlike rebel Greece, because we were committed to all the targets that have been imposed, and we were putting forward all the measures. But in the end, in 2015, people in Portugal were somewhat, I would say, tired of so many austerity, of so many pessimism, of the notion of that there was no future ahead. But even so, Mr. Pascoal won the election. However, he didn't have a majority, and he wasn't able to form government, and the socialists were. And now you have in Portugal a minority government, a socialist government, which is supported by two left-wing parties, including the communists. It's not a formal coalition, but it's an agreement that that has been able to govern the country. And meanwhile, the economy soared. And austerity was the austerity pressure was lowered, and so 2 years after that election, you got to this weekend local election, and Mr. Pascoal did pay the price, I think, of being the face of austerity and being the face of pessimism. And if not only did the Social Democrats had their worst results ever, but the socialists who are now in power at their best. So they are benefiting for this economic growth that you now see in Portugal.
Pedro, thank you very much. Pedro Santos Guerreiro is from the Expresso newspaper. You're listening to Monocle 24.
UBS has over 900 investment analysts from over 100 different countries.
Over 900 of the sharpest minds and freshest thinkers in the world of finance today.
No one has more. No one knows more.
To find out how we could help you,
contact us at ubs.com.
Now, it's hardly a revelation to say that tensions between Russia and the West are higher now than they have been for quite a while. But an isolated part of Norway, is this really the unlikely location for this tension to boil over into conflict? Russia has apparently listed Norway's stance on Svalbard, halfway between the Norwegian mainland and the North Pole, as a potential war risk, accusing Oslo of breaching a treaty that governs what can happen there. Well, to explain this, I'm joined in the studio by Elizabeth Brough, who's a senior fellow at the Atlantic Council. I'm going to start by asking a question that shames me. We probably need a little potted history of Svalbard to explain where it is and why it's so contentious.
Well, it's very remote. As you mentioned, it's halfway between Norway and the North Pole, so it's very far up in the Arctic, and it has a very peculiar legal status. It's administered by Norway essentially, but it's any country that has signed the treaty that governs Svalbard has access to it. So, for example, there is a little Russian town where about 100 Russians live, and there's a Russian mine, and you can go there as a Russian. You don't have to meet the same criteria as you would have to meet traveling to Norway or any other country, which is why 2 years ago Dmitry Rogozin, a top Russian official, went there defying the EU travel ban just to show that he could go to Svalbard and nobody could stop him.
And Russia now saying that it's so concerned by what it says Norway is doing there that it's put it on a list of military concerns, of possible things that could trigger conflict.
That's right. Norway, the country that hands out the Nobel Peace Prize, it's an unlikely adversary for Russia. But there is the issue of the continental shelf around Svalbard. Now, who does it belong to? Does Svalbard have its own continental shelf, or does it belong to Norway because Svalbard is a Norwegian territory, essentially? And Norway says it's our continental shelf, and Russia says, well, this is Svalbard's continental shelf. And that matters because as the ice melts due to global warming, there may be oil to be found.
And presumably that is not something that is covered in a treaty that was written in 1920 or something.
That's right. Nobody had thought of global warming then.
China's also taken an interest in Svalbard.
That's right. China is an extremely active player in the Arctic, surprisingly, given that it's nowhere near the Arctic on the map. But China has been investing very heavily in the Arctic, of course, sensing that that it will be a future trading opportunity.
Now, one of the things that Moscow talks about is that it says that Norway has been breaching these rules, that there can't be any military bases there or any military activity there. It says that a NATO fact-finding mission went there ostensibly to investigate climate change, but NATO could have been up to something. Also says, you know, Norway has sent a naval ship to the area. So in a way, has that given the Russians kind of credibility to make these claims?
Well, it sort of has. It depends on how you define military activity. Is military activity when the Norwegian vessel stops by Svalbard? Or is military activity when you park a permanent military base somewhere, which Norway hasn't done, but military vessels have stopped by Svalbard? And by the way, Russia sent a group of Chechen special forces soldiers to Svalbard on their way to Arctic training. So it too has had military personnel on Svalbard. But this is, I think, a proxy conflict for Russia. So Norway is not exactly Russia's main enemy, but if it can sort of provoke tensions with NATO, of which Norway is a member, over Svalbard, it's a sort of a useful opportunity to stoke that fire.
I was going to say, where does this sit in the sort of the wider context of Russia's, I don't want to call it a phony war, but between the build-up of NATO forces along the Russian border as a sort of confidence-boosting exercise in the Baltic states, between the continued concerns over Crimea, now Russia talking about this remote island halfway to the North Pole. Is this just part of a wider Moscow plan to just needle NATO countries, to just get them a bit nervous and not knowing what's going to happen next?
I think so. I mean, the issue of the continental shelf where there may be oil is a legitimate one, and who owns the continental shelf. But there is also the issue of Norway's membership in NATO. And Norway itself has maintained good relations with Russia for a very long time. And by the way, there are soldiers at the Norwegian-Russian border, often play football together. So it's not exactly hostile. But Norway is also a member of NATO, and recently the U.S. Marine Corps has been beefing up its presence in Norway. So as an alliance member, Norway sort of represents the other side, if you will. And so it's useful for Russia to maybe use Svalbard as an opportunity to essentially score a point against NATO.
It must be slightly disturbing for Norway, though, to find itself on a list of possible places where Russia might end up going to war with NATO.
That's right. I mean, it's there it is, black on white, according to Kommersant and other Russian media. Norway is a potential war opponent of Russia. This is pretty unprecedented in recent years. And I think Norwegian politicians would claim that they have no such intentions.
It's another reason to be nervous, as if we didn't have enough already. Elizabeth, thank you very much. Elizabeth Braw there from the Atlantic Council. This is The Daily from Monocle 24. Now, are you one of the tech fans salivating at the thought of getting your hands on the new iPhone X, even though it's not on sale yet and will probably be in such short supply when it is that you'll be on a waiting list equivalent to a Soviet bread queue? If the answer to this question is yes, then Google is hoping it might be able to tempt you with a few alternatives. The firm has announced its latest phones today and a few other things too. Mike Murphy is a reporter at Quartz who covers technology. He's on the line now. Mike, first of all then, the Pixel 2. This is Google's new phone, the original of which was very well received, very well reviewed, had an excellent camera, and didn't really sell in significant quantities.
That's very true. I mean, it's hard to sell in the scales that, you know, Samsung and Apple do when, you know, your main channels are your own website and a few partnerships with big box companies.
Why do Google make phones in that case? Because, as you say, they can't compete with Samsung or the other big Android manufacturers. They certainly can't compete in terms of scale with Apple. Is it a vanity project?
I get the sense that it might have started out that way or been that way in the past. But now it does seem that there are real ambitions here. They entered an agreement with HTC to basically take over their research and development department, and HTC being the manufacturer of these phones and the last ones. So I get the sense that they are trying to put more resources behind this and turn it into a legitimate moneymaker. But at the end of the day, Google is a services company. They are an advertising company. They make money when people are using their services. So the more people they can convince to use these products, whether it's the phones or the smart speakers or any of that, and basically dive into that world more fully, the better it's going to benefit them.
One of the big problems that Android has always had against iOS is that there's this huge fragmentation, that there aren't that many Android phones out there running the newest versions of the software that they're always saying are amazing, whereas almost all iPhones are pretty quickly shunted over to the new versions of iOS. Now, Google always say that their own phones will be the first ones to get those updates.
Totally. That's always been the kind of approach they've taken. Before they had this Pixel line, they had this another line called Nexus, and that was the main selling point. Again, it was almost more back then a project of kind of just to show other manufacturers, almost like, this is the idealized version of the hardware we would like running our operating system. And that is kind of manifested in the same way that Microsoft has started making hardware. It's kind of manifested into we can just do it ourselves. We might as well lead the pack here.
Now, last year, Google was a little bit critical of Apple for dropping the headphone socket from its latest iPhone. This year, it's done the same thing itself.
Yeah, it was quite funny because not only did they make a joke about that, and this year they made a joke about how the two phones that they have, one is slightly larger than the other, and Apple does the same thing, but their larger phone has different features than the smaller one. Google made a joke about theirs having the same features. But at the same time, the event today felt like about as ripped from Apple's playbook as something could possibly be. I mean, they literally used the phrase, "it just works," which is so associated with Apple that it was quite hilarious for them to have, have said that. And I think that at the end of the day, Apple got a lot of flack last year, but a lot of these companies are realizing that it is actually a way to save space on the inside of the phone by removing the headphone jack.
Now, other announcements today, not just the phone, a mini version of the smart speakers that Google wants people to put into their homes. This is a market where both Google and indeed Apple are chasing to catch up with Amazon.
I'm actually quite surprised by the pricing today. They released they're calling it the Google Home Mini. I think it's $50. And Google made a very smart decision a few years ago to get into the streaming hardware business by releasing the Chromecast. That device only used to cost $25 or $35. And they announced today that over the last few years, they've sold 55 million of them. And they're selling that at a loss, essentially, to get into that market. And with this smart home, they're basically charging the same price as Amazon is for theirs. And yet Amazon is presumably trying to generate revenue off of the sales of the devices, whereas Google is very much more about the services. So I'm surprised that they've done it as they have. But they did announce today as well, if you buy one of the phones, you'll get one of these mini speakers thrown in for free for the first few weeks.
Now, they also announced this miniature camera that you're supposed to clip to your clothing and sort of walk around. Where, and why on earth would anyone do that?
I'm absolutely baffled by this one, to be honest. I've seen a few people, you know, saying, oh, this is great for, you know, taking photos of my kids and, you know, those moments that I miss. And it's like, yeah, but you're basically putting a surveillance camera on you and your family at all times and letting an AI decide what's important to keep. It seems strange to me, and it literally is something that was the heart of a dystopian sci-fi novel, The Circle, that, you know, just was turned into a movie, was putting cameras like this everywhere. So I'm quite surprised that Google is literally becoming the parody of itself with this camera.
Well, similarly, Amazon announced last week a new version of its device with a screen and a camera on it. And the first thing a lot of people around me were saying was, why on earth would I put a camera in my home that could just send pictures to Amazon?
Yeah, it's a tough one. And, you know, I think that that's the kind of giving up of privacy is an issue in general. I mean, that's a reason people don't buy the Echo, is like, well, I've put a microphone for Amazon in my home. And at the end of the day, your phone is also a listening device, so that's a kind of moot point. But video feels like a step further. And I think that it will just become yet another one of those things that we've just decided to give up for the sake of convenience. And I'm not saying that's a good thing to have done, but I do believe that people will see some utility in it, whether it's being able to video chat with friends and family or I don't know. I wouldn't want to, like, you know, it's these little devices right beside your bed. Like, right when I wake up or go to sleep, I'm going to start video chatting with someone. It seems like the worst time to possibly do that, but perhaps people will enjoy it.
Just lastly, I'm looking now at the Pixel 2, at the promotional site that Google have up, and it looks a very impressively designed device. And a lot of Google's hardware is very well designed, has very impressive specs. But not only does it not sell in significant quantities, it never really seems to have the cachet that Apple just sort of effortlessly achieves. Why is that?
Well, I think the reason is because they're essentially just copying. And, you know, we have 10 years of Apple's mobile design, or 15 if you include the iPod, and people understand what a well-designed Apple product is, and they understand what a ripoff of a well-designed Apple product is. And that's why I think you've seen Samsung actually going completely away from the design language, other than the fact that, you know, they have been in legal battles with Apple about their design language. But Samsung has taken a different tact from what Apple has. And Google seems to be doubling down on, let us use this design aesthetic that Apple has created to see if we can sell some phones. And I'm not entirely sure it's the right approach, but if it's well built and it captures 1% of the market, which is a little more than it got last year, I think that would be a decent base compared to every other smartphone manufacturer that isn't in the West, that isn't Apple and Samsung.
Mike, thanks very much for your time this evening. That's Mike Murphy from Quartz on those announcements today from Google. You're listening to Monocle 24. Now, today, the Contemporary Art Fair Frieze London opened its doors in Regent's Park, a stone's throw from the studio. And as usual, our culture editor Robert Bounds popped over to check out this year's offering. Among the people he's met, Neil Wenman, who's the curator of Hauser & Wirth's Gallery's tongue-in-cheek booth about the Bronze Age.
I first thought of the idea on the beach in Goa in January and started thinking about what could we do that sort of thematically pulled furthest away from Frieze London and perhaps slightly too close to Frieze Masters. The idea was to create a space that spoke about a sort of overlooked and slightly underfunded regional museum space. So it's based on this idea of all the hard work that's done by these institutions which lose the limelight or the spotlight. So we're bringing the spotlight of Frieze directly onto that format. And so then there was a lot of fun, a lot of field trips, thinking about which carpet tiles, which wall colors, which broken office lights we would need to be able to do that.
I'm getting a bit of the vibe of my local museum where I was growing up, the Hazelmere Museum in Surrey, and I'm expecting there to be a sort of stuffed bear missing one of its hands.
Yes.
Here, and a sort of dusty diorama. And I don't mean to take anything away from your beautiful display, but it is very true to life.
Yes, absolutely. We were considering a diorama when we had a life-size Neanderthal who was supposed to be in it. But then we decided...
Insert art world joke here, right?
Yes. And then we decided it was perhaps a step too far, so we dropped it. But it was on the sketches at the beginning. So you've read it totally right, yeah.
And obviously you've mixed things up from the ancient to the modern to the contemporary here. Tell us about a couple of pieces that kind of are certainly piquing your guests' interest here on the stand, but also are the things you're proudest of putting together or of mixing up.
Yes, I mean, the whole display has around 80 actual artworks that are for sale by different artists, which you can go into later. And then 50 works or objects lent from museums. So we worked very closely with the Shrewsbury Museum, the North Gallery Hancock in Newcastle, the Bruton Museum in Somerset, and also the museum in Menorca, which has a large collection of bronzes. So they all lent to the project. So they're museum loans into our museum show in the middle of the Frieze Art Fair. So it's all slightly collapsing,
yeah,
as it were. And then on top of that, there's about another 50 objects bought from eBay.
Okay, the classic collector's gene. It lies deep within you there.
Exactly, yeah.
So what's come off eBay and what's been loaned from a regional museum in the UK?
Most of the regional museums have lent, you know, axe heads, spears, Roman rings, things of that ilk. Mainly from eBay, as we see over here, we've got lots of small figurines, parts of brooches, again, Roman rings. And for the labels, I was inspired by the idea of a kind of library card, where you have a printed card, which a typewriter that you then type on top of. So for the eBay purchases, we took the exact wording verbatim of the eBay seller's description as our card notes. So if it says one of five, have two more to sell, that's written on the card.
Reluctant sale, unwanted gift, or something like that.
Exactly. Okay. Yeah. Downsizing, you know, and it's like a Roman ring. You're like, well, it's not that big, you know. And then each of the eBay items has its eBay number. So we're not fooling anybody. We're very blatant about what's eBay, what's museum loan. And then we also have loaned some private collections as well.
So there is, provenance is all important.
Absolutely.
In art, and you've kind of gone back to the year dot, even with eBay.
Yes. Yeah. Yes, I guess.
There's something nice about this. There's also, I guess, an interesting discussion to be had off the back of your loans from public institutions, being a commercial gallery, how those two worlds mesh, because they do more and more, don't they?
Totally.
What do you want people to take away from this?
Yeah, that's a really important part of the project, is that what I wanted to do is look at all these formats and these within culture, within the art world, within the museum world, and really try and collapse them all. You know, so yes, we're a commercial gallery, borrowing a work from a museum to put in our own museum in the middle of an art fair. You know, it's a contradiction on top of a contradiction. And I think that's really important, because actually what we're really looking at are modes of display, how a person approaches an object and how that object has been displayed in any setting. And I'm hoping that through this presentation, that's something that people take away with them, is that, you know, just as other contemporary galleries have other presentations around us, you know, we're showing a format of display as well.
There is something strangely museumish that makes it look like it can't possibly be for sale. And obviously some of these things are loans, but there are obviously two ways of displaying things.
Totally,
the pedestal,
yeah,
and the gallery lighting, the white cube lighting and style,
yeah,
versus the gallery style.
Yeah.
It's a nice place to sort of have that collision here.
Yeah, and also we know we're playing on the contradiction. So of course we're saying, welcome to the museum, would you like to know what's for sale? You know, yeah, it's all about mixing all of those knowns and contradicting them. Yeah.
And that's Neil Wenman of Hauser & Wirth Gallery speaking to Monocle's cultural editor Robert Bound earlier at the Frieze Art Fair in London. We were talking about Portugal a little earlier, and we return there now for this week's Tall Story, the feature from the team behind The Urbanist, which every week goes on an urban journey to uncover something fascinating in a different city. The city in question this time is Lisbon, as we take a closer look at a feature you may have missed in previous visits, the street lamp. With more, here's Monocle's Carlotta Ribeiro.
Lisbon has always been a city kissed by the sun. Be it summer or spring, there's an enduring light to its cityscape, and very few things beat watching a pink sunset by the River Tejo. For a city so well known for its natural light, it seems that very few deliberately stop and look up to the fixtures responsible for lighting up Lisbon before dawn. You see, the Portuguese capital is going through an enormous transformation at the moment. It has learned to embrace its culture, and in the process has made thousands of people from all over the world to fall in love with it. But with a quick look through the city's past, there's no doubt there was a pivotal moment that truly steered that Lisbon into the path towards the one we know today. Let's go back to a winter evening on the 17th of December of 1780. In the center of Lisbon, the king, queen, and its court are all gathered around, waiting for night to fall. "Today," read the papers, "today is the day that the first public light will illuminate Lisbon." Made of cast iron, most of the lamps were introduced during that Pombaline period. And from that day in December onwards, the city was now open at night too. The second phase of this revolution came in October 1878, when King Louis I gave 6 electrical lamps to the city hall to be installed in the city's main streets. This meant that now not only did businesses stay open until late, but people started to venture out of their homes after dinner too. In the Lisbon of today, you still see a remnant of this, as the city has done a pretty good job at preserving these old lamps, even if it means converting gas ones to electrical and then those to LED lights at some point. But if you find yourself walking around the neighborhoods of Baixa or Alfama, you're in for a treat, so make sure to look up. Most lamps are attached to the houses and buildings rather than vertically on the pavement. But look closely. Only here will you find lamps sporting a caravel and a raven on each side. A simple nod to the city's coat of arms.
And that's this week's Tall Story from Carlotta Ribeiro. And don't forget The Urbanist in full tomorrow, 1900 London time, here on Monocle 24. Still to come, we're going to wrap up the latest fashion, and in just a moment, look at some of the big stories across Asia.
UBS is a global financial services firm with over 150 years of heritage, built on the unique dedication of our people. We bring fresh thinking and perspective to our work, and we know that it takes a marriage of intelligence and heart to create lasting value for our clients. It's about having the right ideas, of course, but also about having one of the most accomplished systems and an unrivaled network of global experts. That's why at UBS, we pride ourselves on thinking smarter to make a real difference. Tune in weekly to The Bulletin with UBS for all the latest insights and opinions from UBS and experts from around the world.
Well, let's take a look now at some of the big stories across Asia. Our guest in the studio, Dr. Richard Williams, who's a lecturer at SOAS, University of London, a specialist on South Asia. Thank you very much for coming in this evening. Let's begin with the Supreme Court wanting to know in India why a woman's marriage was annulled.
Yes, so this story is picking up on a very intricate case, which is becoming more and more confusing. So basically, the High Court in Kerala in southern India had annulled a marriage. And this was a marriage between a 24-year-old woman, Hadia Shafin, and her husband, Shafin Jahan. And basically what's happened, well, it all depends on who you believe and who you listen to, because what happened was the bride was taken away from her husband by her father and by her natal family, who have now kept her in her familial home. And they've said that she was brainwashed by her husband, who is an ISIS operative, and had forced her to convert to Islam and then married her. And so the High Court in Kerala had sided with this version of events and had annulled the marriage, and had also ordered a probe to investigate whether this was part of a larger ISIS conversion scheme going across throughout the subcontinent. The Supreme Court, meanwhile, has come in and said, well, is this actually the case? Or, in fact, is it the Hindu father angry about the fact that his daughter's converted to Islam, kidnapped her, and forced this annulment through the court? So the plot thickens.
And it presumably is very difficult for any court to pick its way through what sounds like an incredibly complicated familial dispute.
It's incredibly messy. First of all, there's a question that the Supreme Court has raised about, is it actually possible for them to annul the marriage at all? Is this something that a court can do like this? And then also it's tapping into a larger question of, is there in fact a national conspiracy? And then there's a whole question mark about, can the woman speak in all of this? Certainly some human rights activists are putting forward the case that she is being held against her will by her family and that she's being abused by her father. So it's incredibly complicated.
This next story is slightly surprising from the sentence, the Taj Mahal has been left off a list of tourist attractions.
Yes. So this is a list that's been put forward by the Uttar Pradesh state government. This is the state where the Taj Mahal is the real crown and the jewel as far as, you know, tourism and the local economy is concerned. But the chief minister of UP, of this state, is Yogi Adityanath, who has been very vocal about his loathing of Islamic history in India. And so people aren't viewing this omission as a casual mistake or a bureaucratic error. They're actually seeing this as part of his move to erase Mughal history, Islamic history from his state. So this is a part of a longer history that's happened, that's coming to the fore of wiping out this history in India. But it's also obviously going to have huge repercussions for development, for the economy. And so this story is picking up on Rahul Gandhi and Congress's stance on this, who have been incredibly cynical, but also flagged up using Hindi proverbs, exactly why we should be cautious about this.
Now, it's difficult for anybody in Syria who is an avowed supporter of the Assad regime to be invited to participate in a long interview, but there is such an interview in the Hindu.
Yes, it's a long, fascinating, complex interview with Syria's Grand Mufti Ahmed Badr Eddin Muhammad Adib Hassoun, who is currently making a tour of India. This interview took place in Kashmir, and it's incredibly complicated and layered. One of the main reasons for this tour is to encourage India to invest in Syria fundamentally, and to create an alliance that, in the Grand Mufti's words, looks eastwards and is sort of, he invokes the language of the old Silk Route, etc. He's also repositioning how we should view the conflict in Syria. He says that this is really Syria versus terrorism, and also Syria versus European colonialism. And so he's invoking a lot of sentiments that are very deeply felt in South Asia.
And that does seem to be the tack that many people in Syria take now, is to reframe the conflict as opposing terrorism because of the moves that IS made to take control of the parts of Syria. It muddied the waters somewhat. Is that a message that will go down well in India?
he's certainly been very strategic about localizing this rhetoric. So he invokes Gandhi, for example, and he says, you know, if there was really internal opposition, why would they turn to violence? Gandhi didn't turn to violence, etc., to make his point come across. He's also been very clever about the way he's framing the relationship between Islam and other religions in South Asia, particularly when he's speaking from Kashmir. So the language of the Ummah, is it an Islamic community or is it a nation? And where does Kashmir sit with that?
Richard, fascinating stuff. Thank you very much for coming in this evening. That's Dr. Richard Williams, who's a lecturer at SOAS, University of London, and an expert on South Asia. You're with Monocle 24. Now, finally today, Paris Fashion Week has drawn to a close, marking the culmination of another season of fashion shows. It is entirely possible, of course, that you haven't had time to go to all of them or even to keep up to date. So to help you catch up, here's Monocle's fashion director, Daphne Ezzard, in conversation with assistant fashion director, Jamie Waters.
Daphne, the spring-summer 2018 women's season finished yesterday with Paris Fashion Week. It was the last sort of one to finish off the season. But I wonder if we start by looking at Milan, which came just before, where it sort of the shows seem to be all about maximalism. What was your kind of take on that?
We can see a clear difference between Milan and Paris. Actually, Paris finished yesterday with Miu Miu and Louis Vuitton, which were a collection quite, we can't say minimalistic at all, because Miu Miu never does minimalist, but they were probably the most maximalist shows that we've seen and that we can put in comparison with what we've seen in Milan, because, you know, the exponential growth of Gucci is such a phenomenon in our time in fashion that all the brands are going in that direction and trying to copy, in a way, if I can say this, the success of Gucci. So for some brands that were not particularly, that are not made to make, like, to exaggerate their style, their silhouettes, we can see that it was, they were showing some very busy looks, like Marnie, like Max Mara, like Fendi, like even Ferragamo. And sometimes we can't say that we can adapt our style, some style of houses, of maison de couture, to a success like Gucci. So the only exception in Milan succession of shows was Jill Sander, who dare to make a very simple, minimalistic, white look. And that was quite refreshing for the eyes of all the editors.
I mean, that was also an interesting show because that was the debut from Luke and Lucy Meyer, the husband and wife. And as you say, it's sort of nice when a brand, like, it was quite refreshing what they did, but it was also kind of in keeping with what people expect from Jill Sander, which is that sort of very minimalist kind of perfectly structured silhouettes.
Yes, they stayed faithful to what Jill Sander has always shown. They're not going to suddenly, because they arrive and because Gucci is doing maximalism and is working very well, starting to make like lots of colors, lots of prints and lots of accessories one on the other. So what Lucy and Luke did were really coherent with what Jill Sander and the successors of Jill Sander has done in the past. We could see that with the clean silhouette, with the straight white long shirt, some immaculate suit, and some simple flat babouche that I really would love to wear in the next season. It was elegant, it was graceful, with no excess. And I think excess was a bit too much in this Milanese Fashion Week.
If we then jump ahead to Paris, which, as you mentioned, has just wrapped up, what have been kind of the standout shows for you? Because it was sort of a week of debuts from new directors and artistic directors. What were the shows you sort of were most impressed by or took note of?
Well, we were really expecting what would be the new Chloé woman. And I have to say that I've been very impressed with what Natasha Ramsey-Levy did. She's a very young designer. It's the first time she's taking over her big house. She's the right hand of, she used to be the right hand for many years of Nicolas Ghesquière at at Balenciaga and Louis Vuitton. She learned a lot from him. He's his mentor, and she did an amazing job. at Chloe. She managed to keep the romantic bohemian style of the brand, and she put some urban energy on all the silhouettes. And she said she wanted to show a woman, she did the collection to show the force of the woman and not the power of the woman. They want to show the power of the woman, and that this was the force of the woman. And we can see that on the beautiful muslin dresses and the coherence of the collection with what she did before at Balenciaga and Vuitton with the bohemian romantic style of Chloe. So she did a very good job, which I couldn't say the same for Lanvin. I think it's a house that are still looking, they don't really know what they're doing. And after Bouchra-Jarrah left, after only two seasons, they appointed a totally unknown creative director called Olivier Lapidus, which was a bit famous in the 80s. As we've never heard about him since then. He's not even a young designer. And yes, we probably have to give him a second season to make his proof.
I'm interested with some of these brands in sort of how, you know, the art of making a collection commercial, because as we mentioned, like at Gucci and in Milan, they've been all about maximalism. And for them, that's proven, I mean, a huge success. They're selling a lot of things. And then for something like Chloe, what Natasha Ramsey-Levy seemed to do really well was sort of stick to, it was sort of still a commercial collection. And Chloe, as you say, is that romantic. It's quite girly in it, and it is very commercial pieces. And she still had that, but she made it a bit more edgy and a bit more interesting. But there were still a lot of pieces that people would actually wear rather than some of these very conceptual runway clothes that you sometimes see. The other one that was interesting was Givenchy, where that was also a debut by Claire Waite Keller. And her take on commercialism is quite like, quite understated, shall we say. What were your thoughts about Givenchy?
Well, my thought about Givenchy, actually, Claire, creative director of Givenchy, she left from Chloé to go to another totally different style of Givenchy, succeeding Riccardo Tisci. And I don't think she did as well as Natasha Ramsey did for Chloé. Did you see the show, Jamie, and what's your thought about that?
I don't think it was the most memorable show.
No, absolutely. But there were a lot of very nice things that were going around this Fashion Week. This Fashion Week is not only some catwalks, but it's also opening of shops, launching of new collection. Like, there was a very nice watch that was kept very secret by Chanel that has been launched last night. It's called Code Coco. And it's funny because it's the first time they are showing a watch during Fashion Week. It's not actually only a watch, but it's also a cuff and a bracelet. So that's why Frédéric Grangier, the president of Chanel Jewelry and Watches, said it was interesting for him to make the public to discover this watch during Fashion Week.
Monocle's fashion director Daphne Ezard speaking there to our assistant fashion director Jamie Waters. And that is it for this edition of the Monocle Daily. It was produced by Henry Rhys Sheridan. Our researchers were Daphne Karnisis and Alessia Delana. Our studio manager Sarah Miles. The Globalist is here at 7 a.m. London time tomorrow morning with Georgina Godwin in this chair. Monocle Daily back tomorrow at 2200. And to play us out tonight, this is the National and Fashion Coat. From me, Paul Osborne. Thanks for listening. Goodbye. Don't you think I look pretty anymore? I'll do everything to you, but I can hardly come, 'cause I'm so afraid of you falling. I'd die fast in this city.